Welcome to Don't Panic with Dr. Stephen Cutchins and Dr. Mike Cunningham. Mike is a 20-year veteran in Christian education, and Stephen is an author in the area of Christian apologetics. Together, they will ask and answer tough questions about culture, family, and faith. Thanks for joining us today. Let's get started.
Welcome to this edition of Don't Panic. We're here with Dr. Norm Geisler. He was born in 1932 and educated at William Tyndale College and Wheaton College. He taught at Detroit Bible College from 1963 to 1966 and chaired the Department of Philosophy of Religion at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School from 1970 to 1979. From there, he moved to Dallas Theological Seminary, where he taught systematic theology from 1979 to 1988. And after that, he became the Dean of Liberty Center of Research at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. Geisler earned his PhD from Loyola University in Chicago, and he was instrumental in starting two schools, Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Veritas in Southern California. Stephen, you've had a relationship with Dr. Geisler for several years. I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce him.
Well, thanks for being here again. It's a joy to sit down with you and be across the table from you and to be able to talk about some issues, because one of the interesting things that I have come to appreciate about you, Dr. Geisler, is not only your academic contribution to evangelical thought, but your personal journey through life. There is a uniqueness about you as a person. There's a bright light about you that seems to just stand out from the crowd a little bit. And I think a lot of it is your personality, your life experiences. Tell us about Norm Geisler, not Norm Geisler, Dr. Norm Geisler, but Norman. Tell us about Norman. Tell us your story a little bit about how you came to faith and you know, the background of who you are.
Well, thanks. It's good to be with you and share. I was born in the Detroit area, Detroit suburb, to a non-Christian family. My father was an ex-Roman Catholic. My mother was kind of an ex-nominal Lutheran. They left the Roman Catholic church because the priest wouldn't marry them at that time. Yeah, he wouldn't marry a Protestant Catholic. And so they were kind of ex-bitter Catholics because the priest looked at my dad and said, "I'll tell you what, I can make an exception in your case if you give $500. Well, now, back in the Depression time, which that was a lot of money. And my dad told him to jump in the lake, and he never went back to church. So I came from an anti-religious family, basically. My favorite uncle was an atheist. He swore and cursed. I never heard anyone in my life pray as much as he did, but they weren't good prayers. They were all imprecatory psalms, you know, God judge that, God damn this, and God do this. So that was my background, and I picked that up, and I was the most prolific person on the north side of the city of Detroit. By the time I was a teenager, I could swear and curse and tell bad stories better than anyone else. Meanwhile, I'm going to Sunday school because at age 9, a little Sunday school had picked me up on their Sunday school bus. And I kind of liked it for some strange reason. There was something there that I needed and that I wanted. So I kept going. I kept going every Sunday, 50 Sundays at least, for 8 years. And that would be about 400 times I heard the gospel before I was saved. At age 17... the youth director came to our Sunday school class, and he spoke. And by this time, I'm so convicted that I'm ready to burst because I'd heard the gospel over and over, and I keep rejecting it. I worked on a farm. I was out in the field by myself. I'd fall on my knees and pray sometimes, God be merciful to me, a sinner, because I heard that's what you say if you want to get saved. But nothing happened. I'd say, "God be merciful to me, a sinner," and nothing happened. But I knew I was going to hell. Hell was very real to me. I knew I was lost, and this Sunday school teacher, Jack Richard was his name, came to class, and he spoke. And I went home from Sunday school, got down on my knees by my bed, senior in high school at the time, and turned my life over to Christ. And the key was, I wanted to be saved, but I didn't want to give up my sin. I didn't realize you can't do both. Is being saved is giving up your sin in a real sense. So I never had really connected with God because I hadn't really repented of my sins and given my life over to him. And I forget who it was who gave the illustration of this young man who had a terrible problem with anger. He was a Christian and he had a motto in his life, let God have his way in your life. And he had that on the door of his room. One day he flew off the lid, went in the bedroom, slammed the door, flopped down on the bed, and he looked on the floor, and one letter had fallen off, the letter D. And he looked up and it said, let go. And he said, that's the problem. And I realized that was my problem. I had to let go of my sin, give myself to Christ, which I did. Tears streaming down my cheek, no one around because I'm at home. I committed my life to Christ, February 12th. 1950, senior in high school. Well, it was a transforming experience. I go to school and they know me as the most prolific, profane kid on campus. You know, I mean, nothing came out of my mouth that wasn't sinful. And so they immediately notice a difference. And the girl, I'm reading my New Testament, and the girl sitting in front of me in study hall turned around and looked at me and said, how come you became so holy all of a sudden? And I didn't feel holy. I didn't know I'd become holy, but they noticed the difference in my life. And my first opportunity to witness, and I flubbed it. I absolutely flubbed it. I said, read this. And I handed her the Bible. You know, didn't give my... Then I confessed my sin to God and said, Lord, if she turns around and asks me again, that same question, I'll tell her what happened. No sooner got the words out of my mouth, she turned around and looked right at me.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
Why did you become so holy all at once? You know, just a lob ball right in my lap. And I flubbed that one, too. And I said, I just kind of stuttered. Truth of the matter was that I did stutter because I'd lost all my good words. You can't say much with and, the, and or. God had just taken away all of that from me. It was a transforming experience. Fortunately, we had, as youth directors, a young couple that was very interested in taking us out and getting us involved. So literally, the Sunday after I was saved, on February 12th, 1950, they took us door-to-door on Monday, door-to-door calling, cold turkey. I didn't know what to say except that I was saved and I knew John 3:16, but we were out witnessing on Monday. Tuesday was cold turkey street meeting. Wednesday was prayer meeting. Thursday was jail service. I met my wife in jail. She was playing the pump organ from another church, and I was witnessing, but I met her in jail. Friday was a city rescue mission. Saturday was Youth for Christ, and Sunday was church. I didn't have time to backslide. I was just out serving the Lord all the time. Well, on Friday, maybe a couple of weeks into my salvation experience, we're downtown Detroit. Now, the ghetto was called something else in those days, Skid Row, it was called. And I'm down on Skid Row. And we're witnessing to the bums. That's what homeless people were called in those days, bums. So I was talking to the bums on Skid Row, and this bum walked up to me and grabbed my Bible, and he said, you're not supposed to be doing this. I said, doing what? And he turned right to the passage. And I don't know if he was or was not, but he said, I'm a graduate of Moody Insta-Bible Toot. I don't know if he went to Moody Insta Bible Tutor or not, but he knew this verse. He knew this verse, and it was in red letters, and he opened it up and he said, read that. Jesus said, go and tell no man. He said, now get out of here. Jesus doesn't want you to do this. It says right here. I had no idea what that verse meant, not the slightest idea what the verse meant. Jehovah's Witnesses had already tied me up, Mormons had tied me up, and now a bum on Skid Row ties me up with my own Bible, red letter edition of the Bible, and I don't know what to say. And I had to make a decision. either I'm going to have to stop this witnessing or I'm going to have to get answers. And I dedicated my life to getting answers. And that's how I got into apologetics. Apologetics is giving an answer. It's Colossians 4:6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. That was my call into apologetics. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was just obsessed with if there's a problem, if there's a problem in the Bible or somebody's life, there's got to be an answer to it. And I want to get that answer, and I want to share it. And that began a 60-year-long ministry that I'm still in, of getting answers and giving answers to people of why we believe that God exists, that the Bible is the Word of God, that grace is the Son of God, why we believe that. And I have done what, by the grace of God, what was impossible to do. Here's a kid who came from a family that nobody had ever gone to college. I got kicked out of class many times in the school, several times. One time I got kicked out because the teacher asked me, how did The Tale of Two Cities end? Well, I hadn't read the first paragraph. I didn't know how the book ended, so I said, with a period. She had no sense of humor, and I'm down in the principal's office. Well, it was kind of depicts my academic life. So I become a Christian. And I discovered in the 11th grade that I didn't know how to read, even before I was saved. They gave us a test, and I didn't know how to read. So I don't know how to read. I'm saved. I want to study the Bible. I want to share it with other people. What am I going to do? And God reached down and said, all I need is some raw material. And I was good raw material, no doubt about it. And I stuttered because I didn't have any good words to use. And God said, I'm going to make you a scholar. Well, that's the most unlikely thing. The most unlikely thing. I didn't like school. I wasn't going to go to college. Nobody in our family had ever gone to college. My dad had 8 in his family. My mother had 10 in her family. And so I had over 100 first cousins. None of them had ever gone to college. And God said, I'm going to make you a scholar. And he did. He a little Bible school called Detroit Bible College at the time, later became William Tyndale College, had classes in the fall. By this time, I'm looking toward the fall. And somebody said, well, if you want to know more about the Bible, here's our Bible school. Let's go. So we went. I went there for 5 years, got 2 diplomas because they were unaccredited, 3-year diploma, 5-year diploma. But they had great Bible teachers. They had great scholars. It was a really good school. And gradually I learned how to read. Gradually I learned how to study. Interesting thing happened recently, fits in the story. I've never put together all my articles. I think I've written about 300 articles, but we've never put them all together in one spot. And somebody volunteered to digitize all of them for me and to put them on one place, which we now have and are going to put on our website. But they discovered when they went through all my articles, one from 1950. Now, 1950 is the year I was saved, so it must have been one of the first papers I ever wrote. And I got F. Got an F on it.
You got an F?
So there it is, wow. Right? It's going to be right in my collection of writings.
How would you like to be that teacher that gave Norman Geisler an F, Mike?
Well, I'm thinking about the students who need a little word of encouragement right now and are struggling in their studies. Yeah. That's a good word.
That's exactly what I say to them. I say, look, I am what I am by the grace of God. If God can do this for me, he can do it for you. He can do it for you because I had no academic background. I didn't even know how to read when God saved me. And now I've written over 100 books. That's impossible.
Well, and the thing that I'm just thinking about that's so powerful that lines up with our, you know, passion with this podcast, Don't Panic, is there's probably people listening to us right now that are young in their faith, or they're just inexperienced in their faith, they have questions, and maybe they feel powerless. Maybe they feel unqualified. Maybe they feel so far away from what God is doing that they just can't even begin to see a next step, much less a finish line. And so for me, Mike, I don't know about you, but for me, it's encouraging just to hear this story because it helps me put into perspective how big God is.
Yes.
And if he wants to do something with you, if you can get out of the way, he will really unleash his power in your
life.
And
if you give him what you have, you know, what he said to Moses is, what is that in your hand? You know, a stick. Okay, I'll use that. You know, God can use a dead stick. And look what he did with that dead stick. Divided the waters of the Red Sea, you know, smote the rock and water comes out of it. I mean, did miracles with it. So God took the dead stick of my life and gave it life and gave me the ability to do what I couldn't do. I just couldn't. It was impossible, given what he had to work with, humanly speaking, to do that. Why pick somebody who can't read or write correctly and say, I'm going to make a scholar? I'm get somebody who's studied Latin and Greek and Hebrew and all of that. But God does what he does to get the glory for himself so that we can't, like Paul said, you know, not many noble, not many wise, but God takes the humble things and confounds the wise with them. So that briefly is my background and how I got into apologetics. After I went to Detroit Bible College for 3 and 5 years, I realized that I was called into the ministry, and I pastored a little church. After pastoring for about 3 years in this little country church, I realized I needed more education. I just wasn't prepared. My barrel was empty, you know. And so I resigned by faith. By this time, my wife and I had a child coming. We went away to Wheaton College. Now, Wheaton College was kind of like the Cadillac of schools in those days. There weren't many choices to go to, and it was kind of like the Harvard of the Midwest, the Christian Harvard of the Midwest. I would have flunked out the first day if I had gone out of high school. Mm. But God prepared me, gave me all this background. Now I'm ready to go to Wheaton College. Went there, studied philosophy, majored in philosophy, graduated with a BA and an MA. Wrote my thesis on Thomas Aquinas, which was how I first got interested in Aquinas. So I graduated from Wheaton. I got an MA, finally have a accredited degree. Took me 7 years, 5 years of Bible school and 2 more years of college before I got an accredited bachelor's degree. So don't give up if you if you're struggling. It took me 7 years to get a bachelor's degree. The 8th year I got the bachelor's degree. The 9th year I got a master's degree.
And just as a point of reference, let me ask you how old you were when you finished that bachelor's degree. Where were you in life at that point?
Well, I graduated. Take the next step. I went to school and studied a couple of years, and got a PhD, and that was 1970. I was born in 32.
Okay.
So I was before almost 40 years of age before I finished my master's degree and started a doctor's degree.
And that was back before, you know. Nowadays we have online education. Those degrees are much more accessible. That was a feat. The percentage of people that had that level of credentialing was minuscule at that
point. I only knew two people who had PhDs who were Christians, Carol Henry and John Carnell. At that time, Carnell became the president of Fuller Seminary, and Carol Henry, of course, is one of the most famous Christians. So there just weren't many people who had it. So I finished my PhD in 1970, and here's the irony of the PhD. I just saw my diploma the other day. I said, I'm going to put this on the shelf here. After going to school for 20 years, from 1950 to 1970, 20 years of college to finish the PhD, if you're 3 or 4 years into a program and you're not finished, don't be discouraged. It took me 20 years to finish
That's right.
The program. After all of that, I got the doctor's degree and was ready to go out and to use it for God. But God was gracious in that he reached down and got me in spite of myself and gave me the equipment to get started in the PhD program.
I'd like to ask you about some of the personal things that you've dealt with as you've walked down this journey of not only earning a PhD, but, you know, in the context of your ministry, just looking back on it, I want to use the word legacy. Not only are you an author of over 100 books, books that are being used in very significant places in evangelical thought, you're a common name. I mean, people know who you are. They read of you. They're influenced by your thoughts. They may not even know it because leaders that are influencing other people are learning from you through your books. And you know, I count it a great joy and a blessing, one of those things from God, to have been able to connect with you in a one-on-one setting and be under your direct teaching. I also, because of my time with you one-on-one and in classroom settings and being able to spend some time at your house, I know that you guys have had some tough things happen to you. And, you know, we were talking before we pushed record about one of the things that stood out in a class that I took with you when you shared about the loss of your daughter. And I wondered if you would just share a little bit about, you know, where you were in life at the moment that happened. And again, the point of this is to hear your story and also to provide some encouragement for people that may be going through something like that.
Well, life is not skipping from mountain peak to mountain peak. There are valleys, and the deepest valley we went through was the loss of a daughter. We have 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls. It's called Planned Parenthood. It's hard to make them quite even like that. And our middle daughter was the problem child in our home and very difficult for us. And we prayed. We worked with her. We did everything we could. One day I was speaking in the Asheville area, 2.5 hours from Charlotte, and I got a phone call from my younger daughter, and she said, come home as soon as you can. I said, well, what's happened? Well, I'll tell you when you get there. I said, no, tell me now. And she said, Rhoda has committed suicide. There's nothing that we've experienced in life like that. The loss of a child, that way. I came home, drove home. I don't know how I ever got home through all the tears and everything. Some of the family were already there. We had to console them, make funeral arrangements. While we're making the funeral arrangements, our phone was ringing and phone calls were building up, and we were getting calls from Ravi Zacharias, from John Ankerberg, from famous Christians around the country giving us words of encouragement. And they were all helpful. You know, most everybody said, we're praying for you and, you know, we're sorrowing with you and so forth. But the guy who hit all the nails on the head, I don't know if he was formally trained in it or if he just naturally said it or if God gave him the words, was John Ankerberg. John Ankerberg, on the phone, in 2 minutes, said the most encouraging things that you could say to somebody who's going through a situation like that. I love you. I'm praying for you. I grieve with you. And the fourth thing you would never guess in a million years, it's not your fault. Mm. And that hit me like a ton of bricks, because when that happens to you, you think, what if I had done this? What if I had been a better father? What if I had been a better husband? What if I had spent more time with my daughter. What if? And you're what-ifing yourself to death. And suddenly I was doing what I later heard was a cognitive therapy, but I was doing cognitive therapy on myself, and I didn't realize it. They said, well, wait a minute. We have one person dead here now, and if I keep up, they're going to have two people dead here if I keep on this path, you know. I wasn't there. I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have encouraged her to do it. I would have stopped it if I could, but I couldn't. It's out of my control. God's in control, but I'm not. But the words, it's not your fault, just rang in my ears because I was laying guilt on myself that was unnecessary, guilt that was untrue. I mean, I didn't kill the person. I don't encourage that. I wouldn't encourage it to happen to anyone. But it happened. And God reached down and began to encourage me. I talked to another Christian who had lost a wife, and his words were encouraging too. But the "I love you," "I'm praying for you," "I'm sympathizing with you," "it's not your fault," were the four things that encouraged me on. I was president of Southern Evangelical Seminary at the time. Students were coming in. Faculty members were asking me. Everybody was trying to encourage me. So I said, I am tired of answering all these questions. And the person I was talking to said to me about his wife, he said, people kept asking me, how did she die? What happened? What were the circumstances? And I got so tired of telling the story, but I realized that every time I told it, I healed a little bit more. Every time I told the story, it was a self-healing process. I realized it was happening to me. So it was only several weeks after my daughter died, I said, I'm just going to give a whole message in chapel on this. So Frank Turk, who was in the student body at that time, tells me later that I was the only one not crying. By that time, I had cried out. I didn't have any more tears to cry. And God has given me the grace to give this message to the entire student body. I was told later that Andy Stanley got a hold of the tape and he was using it for his grief counseling for, I don't know if he still does or not, but and I don't have a copy of the tape, but there's a copy around somewhere. But it was encouraging to others to know that God can see you through the deepest valley, that you go through the valley of the shadow of death. He's there. And he was with us. And my wife and I have come to realize that God is good when he gives supremely good, nor less when he denies. Even crosses from his gracious hand are blessings in disguise. And that little poem just summarized exactly what was happening in our life and as we were sharing it with other people. It's still being shared with other people today. Well, you know, things happen to Christians. I realized when that happened to us, and I started to talk to other people, and Elmer Towns' son was killed shortly after that, and I realized, hey, I'm doing grief counseling. Everybody, I'm counseling Elmer Towns, I'm counseling other people, because Gary Habermas' wife died, and here are these well-known Christians, and they all had a tragedy in their life. Nobody is without tragedy in their life, and there is an answer, and there are answers and encouraging things that can happen to you in spite of it's the worst possible thing that could happen to you is the suicide of a child. You can't imagine how bad it is. But God's grace is sufficient. It really is. And he gave us the strength to go through it. We've been married now for 61 years, my wife and I. We have 15 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. And there's a lot of life there and a lot of lives that we've been able to invest in. And God was gracious in giving us so many children that we could share our life with, and the grandchildren, in spite of the fact that this happened to us. We've gone on and ministered. But the thing that probably bothered me the most, and the temptation that comes to people when this happens, is the devil, and there is a devil, and he is alive on planet Earth. The devil says to you, who are you to go around the country telling people how to live when you've had a daughter that committed suicide? And he wants to shut your mouth. And he doesn't want you to say another word to anyone else. And you got to resist the temptation to do that. Who am I? Just a sinner saved by grace. I'm not perfect. My children weren't perfect. But I remember this. God is a perfect father. He made perfect creatures called angels. He gave them a perfect home called heaven. And one third of them rebelled and never returned. Do I expect to do better than God?
Just sitting in this room with you, I can feel the emotion behind what it is that you're sharing. My gratitude on behalf of our audience for you being willing to speak out boldly about this, because there are people that will listen to this, I know, that have similar situations in their life, maybe not exactly, but they're struggling with how to see God through this and whether he's with them during this, you know, and how to navigate their faith life when they're in such a difficult, painful situation. So, you know, the contribution you're making here to my life is an important one as well. So thank you for that. I want to ask you some questions about, I want to go back to that moment you talked about. You were the president of Southern Evangelical Seminary. Mike, you know, and I were talking about this before we met with you, just about your legacy. Mm-hmm. It's not ironic to me. It's interesting to me to think about your significant contribution to the beginning of 2 seminaries on either side of our country, one in California and one here where we're meeting today to do this podcast, Southern Evangelical Seminary. Talk to me about what you would like to see happen over the next 100 years. You know, if you can think about the ongoing legacy of these two institutions, the body of work that God has used you to deliver, what would you like to see happen with that? How are guys like me and Mike, who are students of yours, how do we best honor what it is that God's done through you as we move through the heights of our family lives and careers?
Somewhere along the line, maybe about 10 years ago, I was asked to speak at a group of descendants of the Pilgrims. If you can prove your ancestry goes back to the first Pilgrims, you can be a member of the society. My son-in-law is the direct descendant of Governor Bradford of the Plymouth Plantation on both sides, so it was very interesting to go. They all stand up, and they recite the Mayflower Compact. And so I got the Mayflower Compact out, and I began to study it. And here's what it says. They came here for the glory of God, to evangelize and to be in accordance with the desires of the King of England, who was defender of the faith. And I said, evangelize and defender of the faith. That's what I've committed my life to. That's what the drunk on Skid Row stimulated me to start doing. And so that's my life. My life is promoting evangelism and defense of the faith. I didn't intend to start this seminary, Southern Evangelical Seminary, I was teaching at Liberty. I had to take jumper flights to Charlotte to go anywhere in the country because they didn't have a major airport there. So I spent a lot of time taking jumper flights and coming to Charlotte. And I decided at that time I had written, I don't know, 50 books and been teaching for umpteen years. I decided I'm going to retire from my seminary life and just read and write and travel and speak and teach people to evangelize and defend the faith. Well, God had other ideas in mind. He wanted to get me to Charlotte. And Pastor Ross Rhodes, the pastor of one of the largest churches in town where I attend now, Calvary Church, seats 5,500 people, said to me, don't do anything until I have a chance to talk with you. Well, he said, I've always had a vision to start a seminary. Would you help me? I said, well, if we can teach them to defend the faith. He was an evangelist. I was a defender of the faith. We put together our two missions, same as the Mayflower Compact, same as what the Bible wanted us to do, and started Southern Evangelical Seminary. It's here today because of his vision and because God detoured me from retiring too early and starting a seminary. Now, in addition to that, when we had students here, one of them was Joe Holden. When he graduated from here, he went to California where he was from, and he said, would you help me start a seminary in California? So by God's grace, I've helped start two seminaries since I retired.
Well, I heard you speak one time in a class that I took with you about God's retirement plan, or maybe you worded it, the biblical retirement plan. And as I remember, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you said there really is no biblical retirement plan.
True.
Yeah.
That's right. The word doesn't occur in the New Testament either. God doesn't want us to retire. I'm 84 now, going on 85, still serving the Lord. I have to get an operation on my leg because I can't walk now, but hey, that's no problem. I'll keep defending the faith on crutches if I have to, or in wheelchairs. I'm not gonna quit until it's over, and it's not over. One of my beloved professors at Detroit Bible College gave the advice that I'll pass on to him: get all you can all you get, and sit on the lid.
Let me say that again.
Get all you can, all you get, and sit on the lid.
That's good.
I just kept going. You know, I went to Bible school 3 years old. I got a 5-year program. Well, that's a stack to 5-year program. Finished a 5-year program. Well, I need a bachelor's degree. I got a BA. Well, why not get an MA? You know, I got an MA. I need a doctorate. Just keep going.
Okay. Which is funny because
you're sitting across the table from guys that are into their second doctorate degree at this point. So, not done yet, but on the way. So we're going to get all we can
during the exam and can all we season. We will remember all.
Sit on the lid when we get
sit
done.
On that lid.
That's good stuff. Well, I want to personally thank you as a part of this closing just for your body of work to evangelical faith. I want to thank you for your mentorship and your investment in guys like me. And it's so rewarding to be able to sit down and hear some of the things that have happened in your life and how God has been faithful in those things.
God is in control. You know, I wasn't in control. I wasn't the kind of candidate that normally you would pick to do what God called me to do, but if he calls you to do it, because he said to Moses, now therefore go, and I will be with thy mouth and teach thee what thou shalt say. So keep going, keep opening your mouth, evangelizing the world, defending the faith.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's all for this edition of Don't Panic. Join us next time as we ask and answer tough questions about culture, family, and faith.